Good morning. That was 10,000 Maniacs, My Mother, The War. Before that, the Byrne Sisters, I'm Gonna Stand, a Sweet Honey in the Rock song. This show is called Heresy. And my name is Sharon Griffiths, and welcome to you, and I'm welcoming myself into this room again. I haven't been here for about a month, but I will be back. I'm on kind of a weird schedule here, but that's okay. I'll be back on the 24th. And the 31st of March, Palm Sunday and Easter Sunday. And I'll have something to talk about on both of those Sundays, which, at least on Easter, which deal with resurrection and religion and stuff. But until then, tonight I want to talk about mothering, because although our Mother's Day in the United States is in May, generally the second Sunday in May. Today, March 10th, is Mothering Sunday in the United Kingdom. And when I heard that I would be scheduled to be on Mothering Sunday, I sort of said, yeah, let me at it. I thought I'd have a lot of fun. And I looked through my vast collection of writings on the women's movement from the 19th century, from the 20th century, and through my collection of music, and came up with the show that I'm presenting tonight. But first, one thing I wanted to do. Now, I know that, to paraphrase John Lennon and Yoko Ono, the war is over if you want it. It's all a matter of opinion, this war that was going on in the Persian Gulf with Iraq, and Kuwait, and the United States, and the United Nations, and all those people who went in and thoroughly trashed Mother Earth, for sure. I have just one or two more comments to make, one tonight, that I came across this article in the ACLU Reproductive Rights Update Bulletin, from which I read last time I was on. This is a short article called No Blood for Oil, .. Now, that's been a rallying cry, or a slogan, for the opposition, for the peace movement, such as it is, that was opposing the war. Although this time, I noticed, as far as opposition, war opposition was concerned, people had their stuff together, yes, but they were coming at the position, we don't want this war, from many different sides. They were all united in a common cause, but their reasons were all different. And that's kind of interesting, because we have the people who were saying no blood for oil, that we don't want to fight Exxon's war, we don't want to fight the oil companies' wars. Then we had the people who were saying, the gay activists who were saying, why are you spending all these millions of dollars a day when you're not giving the fair share of expenses to AIDS research? And then there were various other, those are the two I remember the clearest, but there were various other groups saying, well, why can't you spend your money on this or whatever? But the uniting voice was, we really don't want this thing being fought. And even though we have made sort of a botch of the environment because of it, and we have disrupted a lot of people's lives, and it's going to take a long time to straighten this out. I don't want to get into all the political science involved, but at least there shouldn't be too much more chest beating and jumping up and down about how we whooped them, I hope. I would like for us to sort of concede the occasion of our victory, quote unquote, and just get on with things. Let's not let it go to our heads. That's just a suggestion. Anyway, this article is called No Blood for Oil. Some Army Reserve nurses have reported that prior to their departure for the Persian Gulf, they were strongly encouraged to take birth control pills or receive hormone injections to stop their period for 6 months. Officials in the Pentagon said they are not officially suggesting that women stop their menstrual flow while deployed, the Army Times reported on February 4, 1991. A spokeswoman for the Surgeon General of the Army is quoted as saying that a service-wide policy was considered for hygiene purposes, but rejected. The same article indicated there have been reports that access to feminine hygiene supplies is limited, and that there may be problems disposing of sanitary napkins in Saudi Arabia. In 1984, the women's military magazine Minerva reported that Army enlisted women in Honduras who ran out of sanitary napkins were given large sponges. Others were given birth control pills to stop menstruation. Information on these practices still remains sketchy. Okay. So, that is one of the unfortunate conditions of the biological entity woman. We have this nasty habit of bleeding, and when we're not bleeding, we're getting pregnant. So, in order to play with the boys who don't bleed and don't get pregnant, instead of working some situations out, working some solutions out to deal with these particular events in our lives, which most of us start dealing with when we're about 11, and we're usually pretty experienced at it before we start having to do terrible things like enlist and get into situations where our bodily functions are a problem. Instead of taking all this into consideration and building some kind of a solution for it, puzzling out some kind of solution, we have to somehow make believe it doesn't happen, or make sure it won't happen while we're busy playing with the boys. Now, I've got absolutely nothing against, and I see nothing wrong with, women who decide for whatever reasons to play with the boys, to go over to wherever and participate in the armed services. One of the principles of the women's movement and women's liberation, which I don't think exactly happened the way it should have, but that's me. One of the tenets was, we can do whatever we want to. We not only, see, it only went in one direction. We have the rights now to participate and play with the boys, to get the same kind of stress-related diseases that they get, their heart attacks, their strokes. We have the rights to work an 18-hour day in a high-stress job. We have the rights, the right to deal with our stress, to use, in the parlance, negative coping measures, to relieve our stress, as in alcohol and recreational drugs, and just sort of general all-out silly behavior. But it didn't exactly work the way it should have. If we have the right to do anything we want to do, then the other side should be true as well. We have the right, we as women, to become barefoot and pregnant and bake bread and raise 10 kids, if that is what we want to do. The whole point of it all, of the struggle, was to be able to do what we wanted to, not only to emulate men. But that again is an opinion on the turn that the women's movement took. Let me play you something from Fannie Hill, a great band from the 70s, I believe, with June and Jean Millington, two wonderful sisters who were pretty great musicians. This thing is called The Sound and the Fury. Was Fannie Hill. It's The Sound and the Fury, one of my husband's favorite books, actually. Well, let me talk a little bit about my views on mothering, as today is Mothering Sunday, if you didn't hear my opening speech. This, by the way, is WBAI in New York. You're listening to Heresy, and boy are you ever. My name is Sharon Griffiths. Now, one of the first things I discussed with a therapist was whether or not I was a selfish person. I'm an only child, and I always wondered about that because I have never really related to people in what I thought was an unselfish manner. And she told me, one of the first things she said was, there is a difference in the definition of being selfish and being self-loving. And that kind of helped a lot in my thinking about my shoulds and my have-tos and my musts and all the things that I feel are necessary in my life. Why are they necessary? Are they necessary to me, or are they necessary to somebody else? So I don't believe that consciously deciding not to have children necessarily means that a woman is selfish. It could be, as I believe it is in my case, sort of self-preservation. I mean, I'm going to be 36 years old, and I am still stumbling through the process of trying to figure out who I am. It's taken me a long time, but why shouldn't it? It's a very complicated thing to have to do. And of course, now I'm realizing that I am going to be, I'm going to be 36 at the end of April, and that is the age at which my mother had me. And so I came along fairly late in her life, too. And the fact that I had older parents, my father was much older. My father was 55 when I was born. So that was quite an experience, too. I spent most of my adolescence or my childhood explaining, no, that is not my grandfather. That's my daddy. So having older parents can put kind of a crimp in a kid's style, too, as far as growing up. I also have this theory, which is mine, which says that, you know, the talk today, the buzzword today or the buzz phrase today is dysfunctional family. Try to find me a functional one is what I say to that. There, of course, are levels of dysfunction, but I don't know that there are too many family units. First of all, the family unit has been decimated into mainly being a mother and her children at this point, with very little support of her parents or her spouse or any of that. It basically boils down to mom and the kids against the world, and the world can be very nasty at times for that. So I really don't believe that there is such a thing as a functional family. Everyone's got some level of dysfunction. And having older parents is a mild way of having a dysfunctional family. They are more settled in as far as financial matters are concerned. They may have more time to dedicate, but there is not a lot of energy. There's not a lot of almost not peer interaction, not relating to a kid as an equal, but at least relating to a kid as someone whose childhood was not all that long ago. And the fact that society changes so that if you have an older parent, their childhood may have been so far removed from what your experience is and what you're going through that they have no way of communicating to you at all, which was my case with my father. He grew up, he was born in 1900. So he was a kid at basically the turn of the century before many of our modern conveniences were either invented or thought of as household occurrences. So that was a hell of a generation gap, if you want to think about it. And then there was the fact that my mother grew up during the Depression, which put a whole different slant on her priorities and on her, the way she lived her life and the way she related to me. So who knows? Older parents are not necessarily fair to a kid. I mean, I don't run around saying, you know, everything that's the matter with me or everything that I haven't been able to do or whatever is my parents' fault. But I've been able at least to stand back a little bit and analyze what went on with me as a kid and why it happened. And I keep coming back to the fact that my parents were older. And they were much older than my best friend's parents. They used to carry on like kids. My friend's mother had clothes that we liked to wear to play dress up and all that. I mean, stuff as basic and simple as seemingly unimportant as that. It's all a matter of relating. And although I figured out that I personally did not want to have children when I was very young. I remember telling my mother when I was around 10 years old that she wasn't going to have grandchildren. And my mother, being who she was, said, fine, I can live without more babies. So it was okay with her. She was not a typical mother in any sense of the word. She never gave me the phrase, girls should, or you should because you're a girl, or you girls don't. That was a very good thing, and that made me, that method of being raised, that sort of haphazard, come what may method of raising a kid has made me okay. I like that I was never given the shoulds and the shouldn'ts because of sex. I was given them because of morals, because of logic, because of this and that, but all on a very non-gendered basis. And that was great. Another thing that came to mind when I was thinking about doing this show, of course, first comes to mind my immediate experience with my mother and with my lack of being a mother. But another thing that came to my mind, and I'm dead serious about this, even though it's kind of a giggle, is the role model for the mother of the 90s. And of course, we as a society today look to the media for our role models, which is a fairly scary and unfortunate thing to do, considering the state of the media, instead of looking, I should say, in classical literature or something not from this time. It's always, I guess I've jumped on the bandwagon that stuff that happened before was better. But that might not be true either, and actually I don't think it is, the more I think about it, but this is no time to cogitate on the air. The role model for the mother of the 90s, I believe, is Marge Simpson. Now, Marge Simpson is married to Homer Simpson, and she has three kids, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie. She has two sisters, and she is unfortunately to my mind, a classic case of frustrated and wasted potential. Now, I never thought about her much before I saw a certain episode. I used to think that Lisa was the cat's pajamas. I mean, she plays the sax. She is a wunderkind. She is well advanced beyond her years. And that's really cool because she doesn't get a lot of the girls should and girls have to stuff. She's way beyond that. She runs rings around both her parents. But I used to think that Marge was your basic housewife. And I know and we all know she sounds like Lynn Samuels. That's because her voice is done by Julie Kavner, who used to play Rhoda's sister on Rhoda. And one of the first times, this is an aside, by the way, one of the first times I heard Lynn on this air, I thought she was Julie Kavner, because she goes on, as we all